This is Jason with you, Horsley, for the Liminalist podcast between the second part of my conversation with the author Jonathan Leatham. So I noticed you lost your beard since last we spoke.
Oh, yeah, my wife won the debate with my children over whether I should have a beard or not.
So yeah.
It was always inevitable that she was be the winner eventually. Yeah. And just trying to add some pages to the book about the backgammon hustler, and that's about it.
You're saying the backgammon hustler, like I might know what that is.
Oh, it's the novel that I've got in progress that I was thinking you might have picked up the reference just if you'd skimmed through that exchange with Lawrence Rickles.
Right.
Where I describe it a little bit, the expatriate professional gambler from Berkeley who ends up in Germany and Singapore in the book.
So is this the same novel that you mentioned some months ago that you were working on that was somewhat horror genre?
Yeah, I hesitate at the word because it creates an expectation that there'll be, you know, a kind of satisfying amount of gore and fear to meet the standards of someone who defines themselves as a reader of horror, and I'm sure it doesn't and wouldn't. But mm-hmm. In my mind, it's sort of the first time I've written something that has that kind of gothic tonalities as the underpinning. And there is a long surgical sequence that I guess is maybe a little bit hard for some people to get through because of the kind of a blood and guts aspect. But it's really, it's more, when I say it's horror, I mean more in the atmospheric sense of something like a late David Cronenberg film, like Dead Ringers or Spider, you know, an atmosphere of menace and portentousness more than anything spectacularly visceral. That's the thought. That's the feeling about it. And, but it's also silly because everything I do comes out also ludicrous in some way. So, but yeah, it has a extensive facial surgery in it, and the kind of problem of identity comes into it. Of, you know, well, who are you after your face has been destroyed?
Oh.
Surgical procedure. So it's I guess it also has a kind of Edgar Allan Poe.
What's that cult movie? Is it Rock Hudson when he loses his identity?
Yes, Seconds. And Seconds is very much one of the things that I was thinking of when I conceived this book. Yeah, absolutely. Who are you if your face is different? The problem of surface and interior identities. And I like that movie very much. I use movies as touchstones a lot for what I want to write, but I read so many novels, and I think so deeply in those terms, and I project even the cinematic inspirations into novelistic set pieces now. But yeah, I was thinking of, I guess this book originates with a combination of images from films, Seconds, and there's a French horror film called Eyes Without a Face.
Mm-hmm.
Art house horror, not grindhouse horror. Eyes Wide Shut, the mask that Tom Cruise wears in Eyes Wide Shut was floating into my field of, you know, subconscious, semi-conscious inspiration for this
mm-hmm.
piece. And he also wears a similar mask in a very bad but grippingly bad movie called Vanilla Sky.
Yeah.
You asked whether the new project had anything to do or whether it would interest you by recalling the mode of Chronic City. And in one sense, there's a very strong connection between that book and this one, although that one's very centrifugal and, you know, it elaborates in all these different digressions and has all these trap doors. And this book is very, in a way, structurally very clarified and direct. It's the one character, and you just follow him through a sequence of disturbing but coherent situations. But the primary character in this book is, in a way, a version of Chase and Stedman, the kind of glamorous but bemused character that everyone sort of desires but finds ridiculously vapid. And so I was interested in that, again, that kind of viewpoint of the, he's not an actor in this case, this professional gambler, but he's kind of a self-fashioned jet setter. You know, in his mind, he's kind of like a James Bond figure, but no one takes him very seriously. He's kind of a gigolo without sex, you know, a guy who pretties up occasions, who you invite to parties because he's sort of vapidly handsome and suggests an air of debonair possibilities. But when you talk to him, you find him really quite blank. And so in that, he's related kind of to Jason Stedman as a main character, that figure moving through atmospheres of conspiracy and signification, but that he doesn't grasp, you know.
How much would you say that fantasy inspires your fiction?
Quite a lot, along with, you know, personal apprehension, you know, both together, daydreams and what you would say, I don't know, daymares, you know, self-persecuting fixations. And so, you know, there's a tension, a dialogue between kind of self-gratification or vanity and demolishing your own illusions or vanities or purchase on authority, you know, trying to topple yourself into something that will make you surrender to a sense of helpless fate. I mean, I often project characters out of moments where I notice myself pretending to some kind of power or authority, and then it, at the instant that it strikes me how absurd or precarious my sense of savoir faire, having been impressive or somehow comprehensive or capable, the moment I strike myself as full of shit, suddenly that seems like a character to me. You know, the person who would have thought that but gone on thinking that or gone on trying to make that posture effective, you know. Things I abandon become characters. Personas that are non-viable.
All right.
Become ideas for, you know, I mean, I mostly write about kind of anti-heroes, even if they're lovable or have some areas of persuasiveness or mastery. They also tend, my characters tend to be laughed at quite a lot by the world around them.
Mm. So I think you could flip that on its head, what you just said, and say that Jonathan Leeson is the character that you haven't abandoned yet.
Right, that's perfect. Yeah.
So yeah. Then that presumably speaks.
I'm too precious about to commit to paper.
Right. I presume that has to do with the ludicrosity or ludicrousness that you say keeps creeping into your work.
Yeah.
That you end up undermining your own creations.
Yeah. It's struck me many times how deflationary my sense of storytelling is, that I tend to invoke power or fantasy only to put a pin in the balloon. You know, I mean, my superheroes have powers that don't help with anything, and there tend to be a lot of, you know, castles, that crumbling castles in the air. Postures or you know, solidarities, the image of the subculture that's non-viable. You know, I mean, celebrating, it's the flip side of celebrating the temporary autonomous zone, that you're admitting that your structures are all temporary. They're all, you know, Potemkin villages that'll be fun to ride through down Main Street. But if you look around the back, you'll see all the struts and
Right.
smoke and mirrors, and it'll all get blown over in the next strong gust of wind.
So that would have been the appeal of Philip K. Dick. I mean, that intersects directly with Philip K. Dick's preoccupation of.
I think that sense of native recognition that I felt with his work when I was younger, that seemed so, created such an important sensation of being understood, that my viewpoint was kind of represented in his work before I had even completely discovered it myself. And so it just was this vault into both self-understanding and gratitude that someone had articulated it.
So one thing I mentioned in that the piece I wrote about Chronic City was how I can't remember my own description now, but it was to do with how there was a kind of recognition of occult symbolism and occult philosophy in your writing, which seemed to be more innate than actually based on any familiarity with stuff. And that would made it actually seem more fresh and more pristine and more real. And I'm thinking also in terms of what we're talking around now, which is the whole ephemerality of identity, that that's a whole spiritual thing, that the ego is just an illusion. And again, it seems as though you haven't really delved into that and you don't explore it directly in your work, but it is that is a fairly close match, wouldn't you say?
I mean, I think that, I've never identified very readily or easily with kind of coherent, articulated spiritual or esoteric traditions. They always seem to me to carry a whiff or an affect at the edges that can attract me, but the pronouncement at the center, the claim at the center, always seems either obnoxious or absurd to me. And so I seek instead those trace essences around the fringes, or where the places where I see the interaction of self-construction and social construction, social formations interacting with this, indefinable essence. And so I really like, I mean, I've to take this and describe something that's analogous. I always really liked allegorical stories until I knew what the allegory meant.
Right.
And but I like the air of meaning and of interpretation and what it provokes in terms of self-understanding and existential understanding, sense of or ontological sense of what it is to be, seems to be captured and caught up very much in the pursuit of the impossible interpretation. But the moment I'm bored or deflated or made anxious, the moment it actually is given any definite name. So, the places where this hovers into view for me most firmly in to take fictional examples is something like Henry James' Golden Bowl, or Philip K. Dick's Ubik, or Dr. Seuss, the letters beyond the alphabet in On Beyond Zebra, or the magical substance that the Cat in the Hat finally reveals from his hat that makes all the pink snow disappear. These kind of images that have been conjured up seemingly out of nowhere by the writer. The Golden Bowl doesn't refer to an esoteric tradition, but James just announces that this thing sort of has the power to commune and with human souls and unify a sense of presence. Well, this is what I was trying to write about with the Chaldron in Chronic City, and I wanted to declare one from whole cloth that would seem as potent as those seemed to me when I first encountered them, because they both invite interpretation and they refuse it or mock it in their, arbitrariness and their opacity. You know, whereas if the image is the Holy Grail or the eye on the pyramid, you actually are forced to go down all sorts of rabbit holes of actual intricate reference. And I like the invitation, but I don't like to have to take it. The invitation excites me very much. So the Golden Bowl or Ubik are wonderful because they demand and invite and provoke and inspire, and they also are permanently locked doors or mirrors that throw you back into yourself, into the experience of the invitation. I mean, Kafka does this as well, the unattainable castle. Of course, he's in some ways the, you know, ultimate secular, esoteric, spiritual writer. You know, those parables of, you know, before the law. Are you familiar with Before the Law? The guy who waits all his life at the door. And
yeah, Scorsese did a mini riff on that in After Hours, of the guy who's trying to get into the nightclub.
Right. Yeah.
So this is very much about liminality. It occurs to me what you're talking about. Cause
right. We've finally gotten to liminality.
The threshold, right? So, and you're describing the difference between staying on the threshold or staying in the liminal space where everything is up in the air and nothing is fixed or formed. The new identity hasn't come into form yet, but the old one is gone, as opposed to moving into the new thing.
That's great. That's perfect. The old one is gone, but you haven't moved into the next. It's like if Rock Hudson had emerged from that operation with a blank face,
right.
You know, or he'd been invited to go visit the face store and went, but couldn't make up his mind and just wandered in the face store forever. This, you know, I once thought about this in terms of the power of certain children's books. Is there a liminal threshold? It's another word. You know, the wardrobe that takes you to Narnia, or the toll booth and the Phantom Toll Booth, and how in many examples the most memorable thing, the most precious chapter or moment in those kinds of books is the portal, is the actual liminal moment, as opposed to where you get, which turns out, you know, with Narnia to just be a lot of dwarves and witches and Santa Claus, you know, kind of made up of received clutter. But the wardrobe is quite extraordinary, and the tension between Narnia and reality is interesting, and the way time is different in the two places. So I had this idea, which I've never been able to capitalize on, for writing a children's book which would invoke the usual kind of portal experience, but instead of the children ever getting anywhere, they would just stay in the transit, in the liminal space. You know, the whole book would be what the toll booth was like to pass through, or the wardrobe was like to, you know, bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And just, you would stick in the liminality instead of moving, putting it in the rear view mirror and being forced to go into some fantasy land.
Right. Isn't the end eventually crawled across the table a little bit? Like
yes.
That?
I guess that's me trying to enact that, stop thinking you're going to get anywhere. Just be in the doorway.
We'll be right back. seems, again, bringing back to the spiritual thing, because as you know, I've had a lifelong interest in that, a mixture of aversion and attraction to it. Like my stepfather was a Rajneesh, and he followed Osho when I was an adolescent. So, and he was not, I mean, the changes that it wreaked on him were not, they didn't seem to be positive. He became quite glassy-eyed and sort of classic cult follower. Personality. So, but then I ended up kind of drawn into my own cult myself recently, a few years back. Where am I going with this? Just it interests me the parallels between, like, what I understood, what I learned by following this spiritual teacher, John DeRuyter, and realizing at the end of it, or towards the end of it, that I'd kind of entered into this constructed reality that was really no more real than the one that I thought I'd been escaping from. So this is what we're talking about, is you're in that liminal thing, you feel that your old identity is coming apart and your old beliefs and the whole of what you thought of reality is seen to be not, and the desire to actually put together a new reality within that period of not knowing is so strong that it's kind of irresistible. So I coined the term the second matrix, like with remember when the Matrix sequel came out and it was really bad, and there was some sort of hope that maybe Zion was actually a second matrix, and that would redeem the whole thing, right? Because it was supposed to be bad, because that didn't happen. But anyway, I'm just thinking, how does this relate to writing fiction, in that as a fiction writer, you're a bit like potentially a spiritual teacher, in that you're creating a whole world that people can enter into, where they will find meaning and they'll find refuge from their own, you know, existence. But in the same way, you can end up, particularly if you get a following and you end up as an established writer and you get academics writing about your work, and so even though you're attempting to create this liminal space for the reader where they can actually recognize their own complicity with the creation of reality, they may end up actually stepping into your constructed world and thinking that you're the Wizard of Oz and never realizing it.
Well I think, I mean, on a banal level, this introduces the problem of which someone like Norman Mailer is the ultimate case, where the presence of the implied writer or the biographical person combined with the voice hologram of self that a writer creates becomes so obtrusive that no fiction can rival it, and they've self-destroyed their potential to offer a reader any kind of enchantment and disassociate into another world, because instead that other world is always being blotted out by the idea of that human who wrote the books, right? And it's a trick that I sometimes wish I'd been a little bit more alert to in putting myself forward. That I think that it's probably possible to find me preemptively annoying or just filling up a little too much space, because I've been very gratified to talk to people a lot and be physically present in a lot of places. And I'd rather the books come less mediated than I think for some people, they probably have a lot of this clutter attached to them. And you don't even need to be, noticing that an academic has written about me to just see too many references to me, or too many, especially with the internet, too many citations of how I, look or behave, and have that become something that's just sort of stuck in the foreground, and the book gets hidden behind it. But it's also a really fascinating question of evading it in the intimate space between yourself and your own continuing project as a fiction writer. I think it's been one of the many motivations I've had for, along with just a kind of sheer restlessness or boredom or appetite for difference. But it's been one of the reasons it's been good to change what I do so dramatically, is to not sit noticing the role of, you know, Lethem the Brooklyn writer, or Lethem the science fiction writer, or Lethem the whatever particular, you know, the New York writer, whatever particular role a given book might propose, it's often been very useful to just discard it, trash it quite completely with the next thing I do. So it's not stuck between me and the my own immersion, my own translation into a new, you know, virtual reality, a new matrix of words. Because I want to, you know, I want to experience the books myself as a reader who's capable of being surprised by what I unearth in my explorations there. Not to just come up with the next logical Jonathan Lethem book. You know, once there's an idea of that around, it can bother me too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this difference you talk about where the writer might, you know, making the connection to kind of the spiritual insight that you had, or the insight you had accompanying your own spiritual pursuits, that the reader might, on the one hand, be allowed to see the Potemkin village aspect of the construction in a positive sense, that they could be drawn into at some level of extra layer of awareness, along with being enchanted, being transubstantiated into another realm, that they would also see the pleasure of the making and the provisionality of the device, and crucially, be conscious in an enjoyable and positive sense, conscious of their complicity and their participation in the way in which their attention and active intelligence is animating the Potemkin village for a brief kind of collaboration with this, you know, pile of words, this useless, inert pile of words, can be enchanted by two minds working from either end of the reading experience, the writer and the reader, playing together. And I think that I'm always eager to try to have my cake and eat it too, have the books be an enchanting alternate reality that can seem temporarily a substitute for the one we default to, and create an intoxicating sensation of sublime awe. Oh wow, this inside this book there seems to be a space that I can actually enter, and it's like a realm and a world, and it exists, and it's hard to describe when I'm not in it, but I was there. In other words, the illusion. But simultaneously, to be poking little rents in the fabric and saying, look, I made that, and actually you're helping me make it. Okay, now go back to your regularly scheduled programming, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to write out and out metafiction that just makes its subject the artificiality of language. That's tedious. Making illusory worlds is much more interesting than constantly saying it's all just a plastic material. But I like to somehow invite a kind of skeptical excitement about whether it's really a world or just a kind of a game.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's a dangerous tightrope that I'm walking in wishing for both. But, you know, what if spiritual practice could have that kind of same quality of conjuration? You know, like 85% the great and powerful Oz and 15% the man behind the curtain saying, hey, welcome in.
Mm-hmm.
Look what we've done. We're gazing in awe at this giant face. You know, all reconciled and made delightful and empowering, instead of it being that when the man behind the curtain is exposed, that the Oz collapses and becomes pathetic and uninspiring.
Well, he did momentarily, but then he managed to persuade Dorothy and Co. that actually he did still have the power, just because he was not what they thought he was. And so that was kind of an interesting turnaround, because there was that liminal period where they were like, there is no wizard. But
Right.
then the thing they projected onto the wizard, they pretty much immediately projected onto the little old man, like the thing they'd been looking for, they managed to get from him anyway. But there was a similar message, because it was kind of, if you believe in this, then it will
Right.
work kind of message.
I often think this is a really strange thing about the Christian embrace of Santa Claus. Their defense of Christmas contains this very strange double bind for them, because it seems to me Santa Claus fundamentally functions as a rehearsal for secular understanding of a godless universe. For every child, they're going to go through, they're going to enact a ritual belief in a giant, kindly, beneficent figure with a white beard who will be ritually exposed as a fiction that their parents offer to console and enchant them. And it's a dry run for just for disabling the Christian God. And yet somehow Christmas is the kind of commercial Santa Claus version of Christmas with the stockings and the tree is sanctified as a kind of a Christian value, but it actually seems to me to function as the a kind of tincture of disbelief that's baked in, a kind of a homeopathic cure for Christianity that's smuggled in inside
Well,
the children from
hence his name
Christmas.
is an anagram for Satan.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in one thing you said just back there about dreaming world. I can't remember the phrase you used, because that seems to be what personally I haven't been able to do, like dreaming worlds into
That's
being.
right. That's the limit you find. That's the limit you hit when you're trying to create these language worlds in a novel.
Right, and see, I never grew up believing in Santa. Like, our mother was, she would come in drunk on Christmas Eve and bump into the furniture and curse. So from the youngest age, I knew there was no Santa, just a drunken mother. And our father was vocally anti-Christmas, and he joked that Christmas was cancelled every year, and he was virulently anti-religious, so he would have railed against Christmas on that basis. But he also generally railed against God as a great scam that was justifying wars and murder and violence throughout history. So I never had that, not to say that you did, but still, it may be related in some way. To this, somehow I can't believe in the narrative or the fantasy, and so I'm starting from the premise that, or the position of, this is all false, so let's just start breaking it down. I can't seem to get motivated to create the fantasy world that I will then undermine, right? So what is that? I mean, what does it do for you? I don't know if you read that piece I sent you some while ago about mirror neurons and how the brain state of the writer communicates to the reader. So whatever kind of internal state the writer gets into, however deeply he or she immerses himself in the fiction, that determines the level of immersion that is available to the reader, and that makes perfect
That's
sense to me.
very interesting. That's good. Yeah, I do remember that description. It's terrific. And but of course, as a craftsperson of narratives, I also know that my own attention to what I'm making can be variable and fickle, and as a daily operation, it contains all sorts of distractions and moments of profound immersion or deep wavelength work that also really drably, disenchanting kind of carpentry. Oh, I forgot to, make this happen enough. I just know that a page kind of needs certain, nails driven in here and there. And I'm doing, so my brain is skittering to these levels of operational function, and then also to, what's for lunch or how long am I really going to do this today? So I don't know that the end results. I mean, I you paint over the slipshod parts later on, but those aren't necessarily because of a weaker level of wavelength immersion. You know, they might just be because your wavelength immersion in one sense was so deep that you weren't paying attention to the fact that the characters need to like get in and out of the room over here, and so you just didn't deal with that, you know. So it's not all profound. You hope that the results create profundity,
So, but when we dream,
the act is
yeah.
not all. I mean, do you as a memoirist and as a critical writer and writing these intriguing kind of melded forays that vibrate between memoir and cultural investigation, do you feel that you're in a kind of permanent brainwave fugue as they're composed, or do you identify more with this kind of intermittency that I'm just describing from my fictional craft?
Well, yes, I do, and I think that. Well, I suppose there's different kind of immersions, and so I have the problem that you're describing with fiction exactly. I mean, as soon as I start, and this is very nakedly apparent when if I have tried to translate a script into a novel, because I think, oh, it's going to be easy. I'll just fill in the bits in between the dialogue, and of course, it's anything but easy.
Well, that's a horrible fate. It's like writing a novelization of something. You're not, you're, yeah. I mean, so that's. It seems to me that is distinct pitfalls because it throws you into the obtrusive mechanical tasks so persistently. Oh God, these lines need to be spoken by someone, so I need to say "he said" all the time. You know, it's like it just becomes all mechanics. It would defeat
And
the fugue state.
contrivance. I mean, he scratched his head, or he tapped the cigarette coming at, trying to invent these different bits of action just to contextualize the thing. And so I don't have that problem with the non-fiction narratives I write, because I'm the character, I'm the leading character, so I can
But you
constantly
know, just as
refer
there's
to.
this thing called the essay film, there are all sorts of fictional, you know, shapes that literary, you know, fictional writing can take that are more driven by the kind of investigations of a voice. I mean, this ranges from the way Philip Roth sometimes writes, where everything is a kind of harangue, and the fictional scenes only arise as a kind of incidental aspect of what the voice is trying to get across to you, to, you know, a kind of more quiet and deceptive essayistic texture that you might meet in Sebald. Have you ever looked at his books?
No.
Well, even Philip K. Dick working in a book like Valis
Yeah.
is in a way playing with a memoirish voice or an essayistic voice, and the fictional scenes just come because it has to tell you, oh, well, so Gloria was this woman, and this is what happened with her, and you know, but it's all about discourse, not about making a fake film in your mind. You know, here's a scene: a man walked through into the door. You know, a man walked through the door and picked up the cigarette and began talking. Instead, it's like, okay, so listen, I'm going to explain this stuff to you, and you know, it's weird and this involves all this stuff, and so it's, you know, the telling becomes the fictional vehicle rather than the set pieces or the scene making. That seems to me it would be your better avenue than trying to translate one of these screenplays.
Probably, yeah. So, but here what we're talking about, what I'm getting is maybe a bit liminal, because there's a line, there's a threshold between fiction and non-fiction, essentially. So what you're describing Dick did with Vaz is he crossed that line. Maybe he started, or it could have been he started with the fiction or he started with the non-fiction, but either way, at a certain point he crossed the line and he wove the two together. And that's a line, because I've written autobiographical fiction, or tried to. It's a line that I've tried to cross time and time again, and every time I cross back over, I say I can't do this. As soon as I start to fictionalize truth, it doesn't add up, because I mean, I shouldn't say because, but this relates to my spiritual quote unquote sense that the universe and my own existence and my own consciousness is constantly weaving this perfect narrative as it is. So if I change one
Well,
thing.
that's it. You may be too immersed in the experiential actuality of your consciousness. I am probably scarred by some version of childhood trauma that drove me into wanting to make alternative structures. You know, I mean, like when I read your in some ways quite straightforward piece about the crossing the Canadian border, which is very appealing, very the voice is very likable, and you could spend a lot of time with that version of Jason, you know, the one who isn't suddenly falling through a trap door into existential nightmares, but is just sort of trying to do a thing that he knows he probably shouldn't really do, but with a kind of earnest, dogged, charming guilelessness that, you know, it's just very easy to be with that voice, right? Well, I thought, well, okay, so this could be, you know, this could so easily be the beginning of a very peculiar novel about not about crossing the border, but not getting anywhere. You know, like, what if he, instead of being met with a gun at the door, you know, he goes to another house and he's given sanctuary in some very weird kind of commune of people who, it turns out, have preceded him in this hopeless crossing and are now saying, okay, welcome, brother, you know, and so you enter into this weird social structure of people who are, have no papers and have no prospects in America, but have left Canada and gotten to America, just like inches from the border, living by the side of a lake, somehow, like it all, you know, it's like, you know, you could just go, you could just turn that thing into a fantasy.
Well, you could, it sounds like, yeah. And please do feel free. But whereas I would, as soon as you start saying that, I start thinking, aha, but then I think, well, I've had all these other experiences where I couldn't get in. And so then I just start thinking, how can I, you know, patch together all these true narratives? Actually, right. Taking that leap, it's a leap I want to take, but at the same time, I'm not sure why I want to take it. You know, the leap into creating worlds that are so all-inclusive that I can get lost in them.
Right.
So, and you mentioned your childhood, of course. I mean, not of course you mentioned it, but of course, it's, sooner or later we're going to get to that. Like, what is it that forms our gifts or our abilities or our preoccupations, our tendencies, and to what extent are we compelled to fantasize, to daydream, and to create worlds to take mm-hmm. refuge in, and what kind of worlds are they? Because I don't think that my formative years were necessarily less traumatic. In fact, they may have been more so, because I don't even remember them. But certainly they were qualitatively different, and they did lead to a very different kind of strategy.
But this is very interesting. And maybe the key to divergent strategies lies right in this area, of course, memory and forgetting. Amnesia is a great preoccupation of mine. When you say they were probably more traumatic, I don't know, because I can't remember them.
Yeah.
I think, okay, I have, you know, I have reverse amnesia. I'm not eidetic. I certainly can't perform memory stunts, but in every relationship in my life, familial, my friends, I remember more of what went on than anyone else does.
Hmm.
For my social, experiential, emotional memory, and I'm not claiming that I don't have some gaps. I'm sure I'm missing some stuff. But in practice, living my life, I find that I'm at the mercy of remembering too much, not forgetting too much. And certainly, comparatively, when I rehash life with other people, it's always sort of like, you remember that? You remember, you know, you remember the songs that are at the summer camp we went to? I'm like, sure, of course I remember the songs. You know, it's just, it's all there. So my traumas I'm just going to guess. This is a ridiculous, broad thing to say. My traumas are probably less irrevocable than yours, but they're not veiled in amnesic quarantine. So I make up rival worlds to the real, because the real is totally available. You, having suffered a trauma that inspired a strategy of amnesiac absenting yourself, you know, pushing it aside and then no longer being able to locate it, are compelled urgently by actuality, because you sacrificed some actuality.
Yeah.
You lost some time.
Yeah.
And so you want to stay engaged with present experience precisely because of those places where you departed from it.
Yeah, well, it's like I'm investigating a mystery, which is the real narrative. That's the mystery.
Yeah, exactly.
It's already a detective story that I'm living.
Right. It's, you know, it's exotic enough to try to hold on to what's present around you, because you know that there's another option, which is to lose what's present around you. And that may be right where the divergence can be pinpointed.
Between you and I, you mean?
Yeah.
And the styles and the strategies.
The strategies, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I would even venture to say that it has to do with our different stations in life. I mean, because I struggle to attain the kind of status and success that you seem to have effortlessly achieved. But I know pretty much for a fact that it's a good thing that I didn't achieve it, and I wasn't really trustworthy to achieve it, because there was such a deep need in me to attain that kind of power that clearly it was driven by unconscious aspects of me that would have abused that power should I have got it. And that kind of relates to how there's this self-aggrandizement throughout my writing that I've gradually been whittling down and just trying to clear that out as just a big part of the clutter that's actually interfering with the signal. Whereas in your writing, I find there's very much the opposite of that. There's this self-effacement running through it all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I wouldn't say that your fiction is interesting and different. I think I don't find your fiction immersive in the way that, say, Patricia Highsmith is immersive. It seems as though you are present in it throughout, not so much as the voice, because even your voice seems to keep changing, but just at, it's almost like there is this non-fictional element to your fiction.
I think that became increasingly true, and I might actually be pushing back against that a bit with a current project, trying to reverse that the creep that begins really, I think, quite clearly in Motherless Brooklyn, when, you know, ironically, it took inventing a character who was interested in touching the surfaces of reality in a literal sense. His Tourette's had him reaching out to make contact with things, but he also had this descriptive Tourette's where he wanted to sort of stop the book and say, here's what this street was like, here's what this shop was like, here's what this sandwich was like, here's what, you know, Prince's song Kiss sounds like to me. And so he activated a recording instrument in me that had been inert, the kind of essayistic, cultural descriptive stuff comes to life in that book. And then I think obviously it becomes almost one of the subject matters of both Fortress of Solitude and Chronic City, is what is it to want to interpret and describe the world? You know, what does it do to you? What are the emotional, you know, costs and benefits of becoming a critic, right? And in Dissident Gardens, every character, in a sense, is immersed in, well, you know, they take for granted a critique of ideology, that the world is not what they see before them, but that their critical apparatus, a Marxist critique, is necessary to interpret and you know, manage the problem of consciousness and social existence. And so they're drowning in a critical apparatus, in a sense. And I think I've in this present book, I'm trying to sort out. Well, I don't even know that I'm trying to sort it out. I think I'm trying to take a little breather from the consuming force of that, the onset of the critical element that you're describing as a kind of presence of a thinking mind, running the fictional texture. Yeah. Because, of course, I know. I mean, I think with some of the earlier books, I would like to hope that a reader of, you know, Girl and Landscape might feel immersed the way a reader of a Highsmith book would feel. I mean, I love that feeling, and a lot of the writing I love most induces it without troubling to make you stop and have extra layers of consciousness or apprehension of, you know, the kind of ontology of the fiction. But there's no doubt that I've sacrificed some of that immersion in the work after Motherless Brooklyn.
I think the closest I had with your books would be And She Climbed Across the Table to feeling immersed in the story. But even there, I'd say that thing that you're saying with the parable, where you like the feeling of it being a parable without knowing what it's about, with Table, there was a recognition while reading of, oh my God, this is a parable, and oh my God, this is so meaningful, and that did enhance the experience. I mean, I was really impressed by that, the level of, I would say, wisdom in that book. But at the same time, that the price of that was it took me out of the narrative. Sure. A little bit.
Yeah. Well, we've gone another hour now, and I might have another 10 or 15 minutes in me. Are there things that you still had hoped we would conquer, worlds we would conquer? I'm proud of us for getting to liminality into some substantial form.
Yeah, and we've been talking about writing, so that's of course what people want to hear a writer talk about.
Is that how you feel your podcast audience is focused, that they want to hear you talking about?
No, I was thinking more of the Lisa maniacs out there.
Well,
yeah, what they would want to hear you talking about. Not that that was influencing my attention. So, okay, well, even though we don't have much time, but I'll bring this up because at least maybe it will leave a sort of cliffhanger for a future conversation, should it happen. So your breakthrough novel was Motherless Brooklyn, and so tell me about The Motherless, because this is, I mean, when I read The Disappointment Artist, I say that was the, for me, that was the book that allowed me to connect to you, to your voice, to your world, and that was nonfiction, and you've described how that freed you up as a fiction writer, so we could also talk about that if you like. But the turning point in reading The Disappointment Artist was your the essay or the piece about your mother's death and Star Wars, and there was even a line, I think, it's in Seen and Not Seen, where it seemed as though you hit the nerve or you hit the vein, and then I saw, the blood that is running through Lethem, in a sense, to not get too poetical about that. So to me, this the loss of your mother at that time, it runs through all of your work. In retrospect, anyway, I feel that that's.
No, it does thoroughly. I mean, and it continues to. I think I've accepted that I'm going to be interpreting it or forming different kind of representations of it at different levels of literalness throughout the books, almost no matter what I do. And it can almost become now a sort of dance with her absence, as sort of, what form will my absent partner in this dance take next time? I know I'm going to go back on the dance floor and embrace her again, but what form will she take?
Bit like Vertigo.
And Vertigo was quite crucial in my conception of Chronic City. Chase, have I already told you this? I can't recall. Chase, the character in that book, essentially falls in love with a woman who is a collaborative construction by two different women. So he both loves two women, but also zero women, because the one, the hologram one in between them, the fiction of the astronaut, is not locatable anywhere real. She's a construction. I mean, by now, I've mostly exhausted the use of my actual mother's, the parts of her life history that are kind of somatically powerful to me. I've tried to evoke her presence, and of course failed in certain characters. And I've tried to invoke the manner of her loss, the illness, and its sway over a family or a child. And I've had partial successes with that, but so in a way, I'm more likely almost to go spinning back towards something like the Lack now, and just have it become more allegorical and more like the Golden Bowl and less like a character of a mother who dies.
So when you say more like the Lack, as in the mysterious sentient void of when she climbed across the table, because I made this connection at a more intuitive level than rational after we last spoke, between Lack in that story, Noteless and his holes in Chronic City, and how Chronic City itself is this kind of conceptual, perceptual hole that the reader can stare into, and the loss of your mother, how that would be this huge hole in your psyche in some sense. So is that what you're zeroing in on?
Absolutely, yeah. And that but a book as big as Chronic City can have multiple images of the the loss, rival images of the loss. I think that's probably one of the ways in which that book is complex, is that the Chaldron and Noteless's his abysmal holes in the ground, and the distressed astronaut, and Una Laszlo and her elusive fictional construction of a girlfriend. There's sort of a competing and resonating, it's almost like a shell game. Hide the loss, and then turn over the shells, and it's hiding under each and every shell.
Right.
It's not which one is my mother. It's, how many places can I hide and then disclose the howling absence, the howling wound.
Right, because a lack is everywhere. An emptiness is everywhere. It's right. not located right. in space-time. And yeah. lack, the phenomenon, is it's only a lack in relationship to that phenomenal world that's trying to observe it, but lack is also the opposite of an emptiness, isn't it? It's a doorway into a whole other universe.
Well, it's an embodiment of the emptiness, so it defeats it by personifying it. It's a way of you know, making a definitive projection of presence onto the absence.
Yeah.
You know, dancing with it.
Which is kind of like a spiritual ideal self, isn't it? Embodying the emptiness.
That sounds like a punchline. Yes, I mean, and, you know, of course my long, extremely shallow, but persistent flirtation with Zen Buddhism, just reading into works of, influential works of Zen Buddhism is, you know, obviously the nearest I come to a sincere spiritual practice, and it's safely secularized for me, but it also is about gazing into the abyss and trying to befriend it or tickle it into cavorting for me, doing some tricks.
Mm. So have you, I mean, through this process of exploring that void or that absence that relates to your mother's death at that really formative age, have you, I don't know how to phrase this because I don't want it to be too intellectual and therefore callous, but have you experienced a gain in that loss?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I often feel that I'm strangely advantaged by all the things that people would be most inclined to feel sorry for me about.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean I didn't suffer them, but that the self I encounter is now devised a kind of exoskeleton, very capable exoskeleton out of these losses or disadvantages that can, you know, perform a kind of dervish operations in various realms where I look at other people and I think, well, you haven't got this, you know, it's just, you don't have this at your disposal. Sure, of course. It's not callous to suggest it. It's how I experience it, you know, which is probably some unholy combination of, you know, a defense, maximized defense mechanism and a truth about how an artist self-constructs out of whatever is available.
Well, for whatever it's worth, and you know, this would relate to how I presented you in Seen Not Seen as the sponsor, how I began to identify you as the sponsor, which is this idea of one who has gone before, one who can actually be a kind of ceremony master, if I want to bring it back to liminality, as in who knows a little bit the ropes, where it is that you're going, in this case where I'm going, is this thing that Jonathan Leatham has internalized and externalized and embodied something that I'm trying to embody and experience, whether it's sobriety or whether it's success, whatever. And for what it's worth, for me this has to do, and how I would relate this to the loss of your mother at 14, as in coming into adulthood time, it has to do with a kind of autonomy that you seem to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the simple but important names for it, or senses in which I experience it, is I did become, out of necessity, but also with a sense of fascination and discovery, autonomous in a very precocious way, right? Wouldn't be a chosen path, but it wasn't a disadvantageous one. Yeah.
So that would be a permanent autonomous zone.
Maybe, yeah. But the project of inviting anyone else in to experience it is a series of temporary autonomous zones. it's accessing or its utilization is always provisional.
Well, I don't suppose it is for anyone else, and not to go off on a whole nother thing, but that's the spiritual teacher thing again. Is the spiritual teacher can't, a teacher or a rider can't show anyone autonomy, because if they do, then it's not an autonomous discovery.
Yeah, well, that's it. Your therapy is always over when you look at your therapist one day and think they're kind of stupid. they've triumphed. That's them at their best, is the day that they look kind of pathetic and circumscribed from your view.
So that's your experience with your characters again.
Yeah. Well, and it's what I write about, you know, in my kind of my debunking that ferocious, unfair debunking relationship to a figure like David Byrne or Don DeLillo who masters me, and then suddenly I start to see them as just a set of fairly predictable operations. You know, it's a similar toppling of the guru from his throne.
So do you think that that Jonathan Leeson is in need of debunking then?
yes, probably by now. And I do my best to make it easy, but
no, you're supposed to make it hard.
I probably can't achieve the job all by myself, so I'm going to count on you to to put the knife thrust in.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
And that's the end of my conversation with the author Jonathan Leeson. For more about Jonathan, go to jonathanleeson.com. To support this podcast, you know the drill. Donate, email, comment, damn you. Let me know you're out there, or not. I will continue anyway. Next week, I'll be talking to Temple Grandin about eating at McDonald's and thinking in pictures. Till then, this is Jason, the Liminalist, the podcast between.
Well, here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Sur les arbres préparés.